Hi, today is November 20th, 2022. This is Mulvey's podcast number 431. I'm Gossel Ward, good friend John Westfall. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about companies changing hands today because there's a pretty significant one that John and I used to be big fans of, not so much anymore. Yep. But first thing I wanted to mention, speaking of companies, is Rogue Amoeba, which makes Audio Hijack, which is I've been using to record nearly every podcast for, boy, when did I start this podcast? 2008, 2000? Anyway, for a long time. 13 years, mm-hmm. I think. Upgraded to 4.0.6. And the reason that's important is this update brings a compatibility with macOS Ventura 13. I wanted to say 14 for some reason. But I guess it's macOS 13. Is that right? I thought Ventura was macOS 14.
It might be 14 now. They've been doing strange things with the version numbering. We were on 12 for, ever.
Let me look.
And now once they're not macOS...
it is 13. Because Monterey is 12. Okay. I'm still in Monterey on my MacBook Pro. Yeah. So, sorry, folks. So John and I could not remember after all these versions. So I'm currently still on Monterey, macOS 12, because Audio Hijack hadn't updated yet. And I know every time there's a major Mac OS upgrade, audio goes to, goes to hell. And so I did not upgrade my MacBook Pro. I did upgrade my M1 MacBook Air, and it's running fine there, but I don't record podcasts on there. So anyway, Audio Hijack 4.06, it says full Ventura compatibility, no known issues, something called a background sound special service. I don't know what that means. Even after reading the description. Possible to capture audio from this new feature. I still don't get it. Anywho. So there we go. Audio Hijack 4.0.6. I guess I'll wait a couple more weeks because I'm still not convinced that it's really compatible. I might test it on the M1 and see how that goes before upgrading the MacBook Pro.
You are right to be skeptical of it. We've been burned way too many times in the past. That's one thing I've never, and it's gotten better over the last few years, but yeah. Apple major releases break things in ways that don't seem to be, so it's like a nonlinear effect. A little change in the UI apparently is a giant change on the back end in most cases.
Yeah, they're doing something. And it's all, for me, it's always audio that breaks. On the iPad, by the way, what breaks is Procreate, my favorite, doodling tool, drawing app. And so I have not been using Procreate since iPad OS 14 came out for the iPad Pro, because it still feels broken to me. So, but it's been good to get re-familiarized with other tools that I've bought over the years and see how they've improved. And actually, I've learned I prefer some of them for some things, like ArtSet Pro for digital oil painting. But anyhow, so the theme today is changing hands, and mostly it's because, I'm not talking about Twitter, although we're going to acknowledge Twitter being purchased by Elon Musk.
I think we have to. I'm pretty sure every tech podcast was required to at least say something about it.
I think we'll get fined if we don't say something about it. So, now we won't get fined. But I just wanted to, we're going to lead up to it, but we're going to talk about Evernote being sold to some entity named Bending Spoons, which I've never heard of, which doesn't mean anything. There's a lot of things I haven't heard of, so that doesn't mean anything. But, so Elon Musk bought Twitter, and now I'm looking at other alternatives, not because the fact he bought it, or even a political thing. It's just that it's become garbage.
I can't, more and more, I can't trust anything that I don't control. And so I've always felt like my writings and my contact and all that should be through my blog, because I just can't trust it if I don't own it, in a sense. And I even self-host my blog. I don't use a service, even though now it's become much more popular to do that with all the different things that we have. So I don't know. I guess I'm just skeptical.
Yeah. And I should note that by becoming garbage is one of the great values of Twitter for me personally, is that it was a way for me to curate information sources, especially after RSS kind of faded away.
I still use RSS,
and it was like I would choose who I follow, And I didn't really care if they followed me back. That wasn't important. It wasn't a social aspect I was after. I chose who I followed because they had interesting information to share in all kinds of, you know, technical entertainment. What I follow Mark Hamill, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not all technical. And now it's become all political. Mm-hmm. Not a political animal. Even the technical people are talking politics now. Yeah. You know? And some of the some of the tweets have dropped off from some of the sources I'd become kind of accustomed to reading and learning from. And you might remember Flipboard in the early days of the iPad, I guess. Or no, early days of the iPhone. Flipboard was such a great way to create kind of a online magazine from, you know, tweets you followed, right? It was just wonderful. Don't know whatever happened to Flipboard, but that value has gone away. So not sure what to do. It's become less interesting for me. I'm sure if you're a political person, it's really interesting, but for me, not so much. So that's Twitter. That's the other things that came to my attention over the past calendar year, well, I should say in 2022, is Broadcom bought VMware, you know, which was bought by EMC, which is bought by Dell. So it's changed hands several times. So I don't, unlike Twitter, I'm not really afraid of it changing in a bad way. You know, they seem to just move forward regardless who is the majority owner. And then one I had forgotten about when I was looking through who bought whom is HP bought Poly, which used to be known as Polycom. And anybody who's done a lot of conferencing and needed specialty conferencing gear, whether video or audio, remembers Polycom. I think they had some pretty decent headsets too, you know, for the the lower end of the scale. But HP bought Poly, which I kind of vaguely remember happening early this year. But the thing I wanted to talk to John about, and if I had more time, I would have invited some other friends who may have had some thoughts, is Evernote, which I used, I hope I don't use the word sacrilegiously, but I used religiously for many years. I was bought by something called Bending Spoons. And, you know, it's been fading for years. John and I stopped using it for our show notes years and years and years ago. We use Google Docs. We have been using Google Docs for years and years and years now. And I just don't know what happened to Evernote. They were such a great company, you know. Well, it had such a great product. I guess they weren't a great company because they've kind of faded away. But they seem to have been a great company back in the, you know, late aughts. Yeah. The mid to late aughts. In the mid, you know, at the turn of the millennium, so to speak. When they shifted from being a Windows scrolling toilet tissue note-taking app to an online app. And in fact, I'll put a link to a conversation, an interview I did with its then CEO, Phil Leiben, back in January 2009. So many, 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 many years ago in internet years. You know, he had great ideas. He had moved the company to a, you know, different level. Like I said, I used it every single day, 7 days a week. I think John too.
Oh, yeah. For a good 3 or 4 years, I was just everything. I went into Evernote. And Evernote was the first. So I was thinking a while ago about what made Evernote interesting and why I liked Evernote. Mm. And it was the first time I had unity in certain things. Good where, point. You know, you could embed files into Evernote. I did a lot of that. I had files attached to a bunch of notes, which you could, if you then exported them as HTML, you would then get a folder with the attachments on there. So even under HTML, it was a usable format, you know, if you exported. And I think it was the first time I started to really think about what would it look like if I didn't have a file folder structure to organize my files and organize all these things. And in a way, I then took from that, you know, my usage into OneNote, and I still do embed some files in OneNote. But in a lot of ways, I realized that when you do that, my brain just works better on file folders. Maybe it's just because I'm older and that's what I've thought about for a number of years, or where's this file? How is it stored? So when Evernote started to fade and I went back to mostly flat file storage, although I do still use some of the note taking apps. I use Apple Notes quite a bit now. I use OneNote quite a bit. And also at the time we had talked about how many fragmented note taking systems do you want? So for me, it was, if I'm already starting to use Apple Notes because it's on everything, that I use. And then I'm using OneNote because I can build these notebooks I can easily share that sort of emulate paper notebooks. Do I really need a third? And that's where Evernote just sort of was, you know, master of none of those things. And especially when it became that you had to have premium with Evernote for it to even be halfway usable. The whole idea of, oh, you can only have it on two devices and you can only attach small files, it just became a joke after they basically said you've got to have premium or else.
Yeah. And, you know, I can't remember what their take rate was. It was in the small digits, obviously. Otherwise, they would have been, you know, they would still be an independent company or bought by one of the big players. But, yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I kind of felt the same way. I should note that I actually had a premium account that was actually given to me by Phil and their CTO. So I didn't even have to pay for it, which, you know, made me a little jaded, I suppose, because I said, oh, it works great, you know. But for everybody else, not so much, and I can understand that. I don't even know if my premium account is still valid. Probably not. I haven't logged in a long time. I should.
I am still happy about that. I can still get back to my Evernote if I want to through the web, but the web interface is horrible. At least it is every time I try to use it. So it's just a bunch
it used
of
to be
things
good.
Started breaking. Yeah, a bunch of things started breaking on Evernote as soon as I started to transition away, and I think many of us did as well.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, the synchronization breaking. There are two kinds of synchronization. Synchronization number one is the one you use every day. Is like you said, you know, go to the web, go to an app, everything synchronized. And then that started breaking. You'd be on your iPhone taking some notes, and then later on you'd pop to the web and it wasn't synchronized yet, even though it might be an hour later or something or more.
Well, that was why we originally stopped using it for our show notes.
Yeah.
Because you would make edits I wouldn't see, and I would make edits you wouldn't see, and it became very frustrating.
Yeah, and it's worse if you have more than one person. I was just me, you know, synchronizing me to me was a problem. So, it's too bad because I still prefer its original UI UX to OneNote, for example. I still don't like the idea of little boxes in OneNote. I would just rather have one continuous note per note, you know, so to speak, or continuous set of pages, whatever you want to call them. I do use OneNote. I've been trying to come to grips with it since, you know, I pay for my personal $99 a year or whatever, Office 365. I'm trying to come to grips. I also use Google Keep, which is free, keep.google.com. And so I think those are plus Apple Notes. Like you said, now that Apple Notes is smarter, you can share. And I think if you go to iCloud.com, I think it's also there. I should go check that. So you can get
it. Remind me, there is a new iCloud.com.
Yeah.
That we could talk about. Yeah.
Yes. In fact, I just read about it the other day and I forgot to put it in our show notes, but very good topic. I'm typing iCloud.com now. So now I got to remember my password and stuff, but that's okay. So Evernote, boy, you know, it's not dead. But golly, you know, once it goes downhill and starts degrading, and then you see a company you never heard of buy it, you got to wonder where it is, right? In the scheme of things. I'm looking at bendingspoons.com now, and I get taken to it's really slow. It's a really slow website, not a good sign, mostly because it's all photos at the top. They claim to have 90 million active users for something, 500 million app downloads, which is not good. If you have 90 million active users, but 500 million people have downloaded it, that's not a good take rate, but I guess it's better than zero. And 50 state-of-the-art in-house technology. So it sounds like some kind of a holding company more than a dev. Mm-hmm. And I still don't know what... here's their products. What do they have? And it's really slow. The website is really slow. It's like an old flash site or something. Mostly too many photos, bending spoons, too many photos on your website. You know, more info, less photos. Your photos are not very informative, just FYI. My UI UX commentary to you. And I'm looking and I'm looking and I still have no idea what they sell. But, so video editor and something else. They should just list what they sell. AI-powered photo enhancement and restoration. Don't know the name, so not good marketing. Anyway, bendingspoons.com. If you like me, are curious and you haven't clicked on their website, it's really slow, so be patient. It's your web is not broken. You go there, it just seems like it. Yeah, I'm looking forward to, by the way, I'm not sure it's really a note-taking app, but I'm looking forward to that. What is that new whiteboard app that's supposed to be released with iPad OS?
Freeform,
thank you. I'm looking forward to that. That's supposed to be released in less than a month now, I think middle of December. So maybe 3 weeks from now, we should see it with iPad OS 16.2. I think it'll be an iPhone too, so I guess iOS 16.2 and the Mac. So I don't know if there's a web version, probably not. And I suspect it won't be as much fun to use without a stylus or touch-enabled device. So we will see. And again, I will put up a link to my conversation with former Evernote CEO Phil Leiben back in 2009 in our show notes. And that, that leads up to your kind of a follow-up sequel to our discussion.
Well, and I think this leads to a good... There's a few things here that we can talk about that I think... these are some classic debates of productivity, I think, that I wanted to kind of walk through. We mentioned iCloud.com, and I just pulled up iCloud.com. It is a very nice refresh. It looks very pretty. The problem I have with it is that there's no way, unlike on my iPhone, where I can integrate two ecosystems, iCloud.com, I can't integrate my work and my personal, which is sort of annoying. My work is on Office 365. My personal is on iCloud. So it would be nice if I had a unified view. And the other iCloud.com thing that just perplexes me is why Safari bookmarks are not available. Because if you think about it, if I'm using this website if I'm on my Mac or on my iPad, I'm just going to use the native apps that are built in. This website looks like it would be great if I'm on a computer that's not mine and I need my calendar, my photos, all those things, my notes. So I don't know why the iCloud bookmarks are not there. But anyway, this brings me to my first versus. So web apps versus native. And iCloud.com, Google's cloud, Microsoft 365, all their web apps versus their native apps. So what do you tend to prefer and where do you think one excels over the other?
Good question. I used to prefer native versus web, but as I started to have a much more heterogeneous ecosystem, I prefer the web. Because I switched between Windows and Mac OS and Chrome OS and Android and whatever else, Linux on the Raspberry Pi. So if it's on the web and I don't have to download an app, I'm pretty happy these days. That said, there are some services or applications that have both a native, not all have both, but like Teams. Yep. Teams on the web is not nearly as good or useful as a native full-featured app. And by full-featured, I mean the iPad version, iOS version of Teams doesn't have all the features. Like I think I can't see trend lines, regression lines in Excel if I bring it up through Teams on iPad OS, or on a PC, if I'm using a web version, I think so. If I'm using a web version, I have to use a full desktop app to see anything. So those kind of things are kind of annoying. But that said, what about you, John?
I used to be much more web app based, and now I try to use native apps for everything. And really? I don't know if that's just the old man in me that really does not like web. But the only time I find web useful is if I'm on some other computer that's not one of my computers.
Right.
But if I'm on my own system, I want everything I want to work as fast as possible. And I just do not think web apps are fast enough, at least in my opinion.
Interesting. You have any specific example that it really,
Office 365 loading up documents. It seems like it loads faster on my computer than loading an Office 365 document. Also, there's some weirdness when you have a personal Office 365 and a work Office 365, as I'm sure you've noticed, where, there should just be a toggle where I can say, go to my Office, my work account versus my home account.
Right.
That doesn't seem to work. Half the time it'll log me into the wrong account.
Yes.
And that gets very frustrating.
Yes. Or it won't let you log in.
Yeah.
It
won't let me swap around to the different accounts that I need. So that is where I think I get frustrated with the whole idea of a cloud ecosystem and web app ecosystem.
Interesting. Yeah, in fact, I have to admit that Office for the web in particular seems to be getting better, but still not good. You know, and I haven't tried this in a while because I haven't worked with really large documents in a while. But, you know, when I used to have, I guess it's not really large, but relatively speaking to what I do these days, when I used to have 80, 90, 100 page documents, trying to use Microsoft Word in a web version was just abysmal. It was I couldn't even scroll pages at one point. So I don't know if that's improved lately. I hope it has.
Well, and even then, even first-party apps have problems. You know, not first-party, but native apps have problems with big Word documents. I've seen, if you have a Word document that's over, in my opinion, 60 or 70 megabytes in size, you're going to have issues.
And especially if you have graphs and photos and so forth.
At that point, do yourself a favor and learn LaTeX or something. You know, actually go with something that's designed for large document management and those sorts of things.
Well, you know, as somebody who struggled through NROTH, TROTH for my thesis, I'm not sure I want to go back to something that manual, but I hear what you're saying. Sometimes you have to take the hit to get what you want.
So that brings to my next question, which is, I talked about how you know, there are, you know, native versus web, all that. The other one I have is third party versus first party. Do you use the stock applications for things, or do you have third party apps that you prefer better? So for a long time, I did not use iOS Mail. I used Outlook, and I've gone kind of back to iOS and Mac Mail just because, I don't know, I just seem to work with that better. I used to use a third-party calendar application. Now I've gone back to stock calendar. And it's mostly just because it's easier to get up and running on a device. I don't have to install it. It's right there if it does what I need it to do. So what are your must-haves on first-party versus third-party?
Wow, that's an interesting question because I flip-flopped a bit. You know, I hate Outlook, first of all. It's fine under, you know, on a desktop, I guess. Well, maybe fine is not the word. It's acceptable on a desktop. It does what it's supposed to do for me. But I've never really liked it for personal use. So I've always used, at least on the iOS ecosystem, I've always used a native mail app for most things. I do use the Gmail app every now and then. I can't remember why. Calendar, I actually do all my calendaring in Google Calendar, but I look at it in the Apple Calendar. So I guess that's a split. One thing I will say I refuse to use is the Apple Podcasts app, which is garbage. So I have, I use, what am I using? I'm using Overcast right now, I think, which is also free. And that seems to do the trick for me. I'm trying to look at what else I have that might come under the heading of native versus third party. I think that's about it. You know, weather. Dark Sky was my go-to, which is going to be turned off the first of the new year, by the way, because Apple bought it, ruined it. They've integrated it with their own weather app, but it's not nearly as good or fast as Dark Sky. The render time is abysmal. It doesn't provide as much information, in my opinion. It's pretty disappointing how they integrated it, and they're turning off Dark Sky. And I kind of wonder how it's going to affect other apps that use the Dark Sky engine, like Carrot Weather, which I really like. I wonder if Carrot's going to force me to go to a premium in order to, you know, basically, yes, I got to pay again. I paid for it once. You know, one and done kind of thing. And it does use Dark Sky as a source. I'm not sure whether, I guess it has other sources, but they're all locked. So that answers my question. In order to use any of the other sources of weather, I'm going to have to pay money, I guess. I'm going to have to stop using Carrot Top. Carrot Top. Carrot Weather, which I paid for, which is, I'm kind of bummed about. Because I really don't want to pay premium for Carrot, for something I feel like I paid for already. So I guess I'll be stuck with Dark Sky gone and Carrot Weather gone. I guess I'll be stuck with Apple's weather. And I should note, I've tried the other weather apps, including my local TV stations apps, and they're garbage. They have really, really intrusive ads. I don't mind ads. I just don't like it when they take over my screen and show me a video, and I don't need that. So those all got uninstalled after trying them.
I like those intrusive ads. I don't like intrusive ads either, you know. Just place,
yeah. Ads. But,
yeah, like I said, I've tried to go back to stock for a lot of things just because it makes life a little easier when getting onto a new device. But, yeah, sometimes it is just crap, and it's frustrating.
It's like, you know, in Windows, I tried StarDock and some other UI enhancements years and years ago. And they're great, by the way, nothing against them. But it meant I had to either, you know, I couldn't use it at work because I couldn't install it at work, or I could install it at work, but I have to buy another license. And I wanted the same experience wherever I went in the, you know, the operating system platform itself. And so I stopped customizing. And now that I'm using Windows 11 on my, you know, retiree PC, and they changed the UI UX without, you know, asking me, boy, that's been, now I remember why I don't like changing UI UX by choice from platform, from place to place. So when I'm on Windows 10 at work, because I can't upgrade my PC to 11 because it just won't, you know, it's one experience. And then my retiree PC at home with running Windows 11 Pro is a whole different experience, which I'm not sure I like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so next one, one-off versus ecosystem. So what do you want to use in sort of, you know, a whole ecosystem where you're okay with good enough, like Office 365 or something in iCloud or something in Google, versus you really want a dedicated one-off app that just does it really well?
Ooh. So the Unix approach?
Yep.
Where every tool has one function and one function only, if it's designed right, and then you put them all together. Most of the time, I'm fine with using an ecosystem. I'm trying to think of, aside from, you know, Unix components or Linux components, there's not many one-offs. And sometimes there's no analog in the ecosystem, like recording this podcast. I have no idea how to record a podcast on Windows. I've been using Audio Hijack from Rogue Amoeba for over a decade now. I've looked for recording apps in Windows, have never found one that worked for me. You know, the trial versions and so forth. So I don't know. What about you?
So for most part, I've tried to go to ecosystems because they're, you know, they talk to each other. I like that. Mm-hmm. There are certain things that I still can't get fully into an ecosystem. So, for example, there's a little app I use called Serial Mailer on Mac OS that basically does quick mail merges.
Okay.
And it's easier to get set up and running than using mail merge in Office most of the time. So I will do that so that I can send out very quick, targeted, personalized mailings. Occasionally, I will jump between ecosystems if something does something better. So, for example, Numbers, Apple's
spreadsheet
software, will actually do live updating graphs. And what I'll do sometimes for teaching demonstrations is I will want to have students reading me off data in the classroom, and as they're talking, I'll be entering it into a Numbers spreadsheet, and they can see the graph live updating.
I did not know that.
Entry. Yeah, so that's kind of a cool way of interactive work that I like to use it for. So sometimes it's not all about one or the other. Sometimes it is just this one has this one particular feature, and I'm going to use that. But I try to stay in an ecosystem for that instead of just one-off apps as much as possible, just because the one-offs can be a little bit hard to remember. In fact, I still have a note in Apple Notes of all my essential MacBook software, including, you know, installers and registration codes and all these other things. And it's still a pain, even though it's a smaller and smaller list than it ever has. The 2022 version is a lot smaller than the 2020 version. And I have them kind of in the same note to look at each other. But I think in general, I'm trying to simplify my life a little bit more. And that, actually leads me to my next one.
Mm-hmm.
What do you use command line for versus a front end? Is there anything that you just say, you know what, command line's quicker, I'm just going to go with that?
You know, on Windows, I do not use command lines anymore. I used to have either, CMD, you know, DOSBox or PowerShell open. But these days, I don't do anything on a command line that I can think of, unless something's broken, and I can manually go look at something. On the Mac, however, terminal is open 24/7. Whenever I've got a Mac running, terminal is open. In fact, I'm looking at it right now. I have terminal running all the time.
Yeah, I do use terminal a lot on a Mac. I was doing things that I realized I didn't need to have a dedicated app for. For example, there's a very nice terminal app I have called Core Shell, and I also have one called Core Tunnel. They're both made by the same group. They allow you to have shortcuts to, you know, different servers and things like that. Core Tunnel is really great if you have software that runs on the local machine, but it's behind a firewall, so you can't directly access the port. You can tunnel the port over SSH to your computer. So, but again, I could use command line for most of these things. I know the syntax for them. And I've actually started using terminal a bit more than going into Core Shell, just because I use the same SSH keys, and so I can already just use the SSH command to get into a machine much quicker. So, yeah, there are some front ends. I will say, Core Tunnel, to be able to set up that SSH tunneling command in the right way, I do use that all the time because I hate trying to remember the syntax of that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But that's a pretty specific thing that I doubt many of our listeners worry about.
For me, it was, you know, until Windows and Mac, until search became a thing that was actually functional, it would be easier to use find in either a DOS box or a Unix shell on a Mac OS to find files, especially using wildcards. Mm-hmm. Now it's actually pretty easy using, you know, the GUI. So not as much, but I think for like mass deletes, I feel safer using the shell. I don't know why. It's probably not safer because I don't think I've got it set up to automatically send to trash. I think I literally delete when I use the shell. But anyway.
Oh, you're one of those people that just tempts fate.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I used to be a Unix admin, I used to alias RM to actually move stuff to, you know, an invisible trash bin or to dot trash or whatever. But, you know, sometimes you got to walk the high wire without a net.
I mean, if you're comfortable with it, I'm fine with you doing it. That's your business. So here's another one that goes back to our Evernote topic.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when I was in college, I used a laptop to take notes, and I just used Word for everything. There was no dedicated note-taking apps. So in technicality, you could use a word processor for everything that we use, Apple Notes or Google Docs or Google Keep or OneNote. So what do you still use a word processor for that you could use in those apps versus what you use those apps for?
You know, it depends what you consider Google Docs. But if you I don't consider Google Docs a full word processor because I don't think it has all the features of a full word. I don't know, actually. It's gotten pretty powerful. I'm using it right now, so maybe I shouldn't badmouth it. What does it have? Can I do like indexes and table of contents? You can do a lot, but I don't see index and table of contents yet. Oh yeah, there is a table of contents. I lied. Never mind. Right at the bottom of insert, there is table of contents. So I guess it is fuller feature work, but I'm so, let me rephrase it. I am so old. As I said, I used nrof troff, and I didn't even have Emacs. I used VI to do all my word typing, word smithing, and then process using what would we call it? Well, it's dot commands. I guess we'd call them tags these days. So I didn't have a word processor. I remember being really excited the first time I saw a word processor that formatted live on my screen. And I thought it was magic. I'm pretty happy using note-taking apps for almost everything except for actually producing a document. I remember when I was a DoD contractor, I remember keeping everything on a secure Unix box in just text files using VI. And those are my daily notes. I just kept running notes using VI and text files. That was fine. And they're searchable easily, you know. Mm-hmm. And I can manipulate them. It was wonderful, actually, now that I think about it.
Yeah, I think about a lot of the way that I decide is it going to go into OneNote or Apple Notes or Word. Yeah. Is if I think I'm ever going to disseminate it to someone. Mm. And if I'm ever going to send it somewhere, then it goes into a Word document. Or if I'm ever going to print it out and give copies to people, it goes into a Word document. Although occasionally I will print from OneNote or Apple Notes. But that's sort of my rule, is if it needs to be presentable to other humans, then I probably should put it in a word processor.
I do have an intermediary at work, and that is Microsoft Teams. The text, what do you call them? I guess chats, the group chats, which I hesitated to call it that because there is something called a group chat, which is different from a chat in a Teams channel, but they look very similar. They're not the same. You can really format pretty well in them. Light formatting in boldface and quote things and bullet points and insert photos and all of that. So I use that a lot to communicate short pieces of information, a page or less. I think there's a limit on the size of the text box also, so that self-limits mm-hmm. you. But like you, if it's got to be presentable, I will use Word or PowerPoint. As I do a lot of stuff in PowerPoint that probably should be in Word. Because we talked about this the other week, right? I like to bullet point things a lot because I think it's just faster to communicate with people who are not going to read my, what they might consider my dense text. So if I want to get a point or points across, pun intended, I will bullet point it the heck out of it. Like, yep. Here are the three things you need to do. You don't have to read a paragraph to tease them out. These 1, 2, 3, these are it.
Just do this. Yeah. Just listen to me and do it.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and then that brings me to, I have two more of these where it's kind of hyper-specific versus general. And the first is productivity or task-oriented apps versus just a task manager like, built into Outlook, Microsoft's tasks, or I guess you could use Microsoft To Do with the same backend or Apple Reminders. I used to use Streaks, which let you keep track of how...
I remember
how many times you would use something. The problem is I was using it as my daily to-do list, and I thought, well, I could just put that in Reminders, and that would be just as easy. I don't really care about how many days I've done it. I more care about,
doing it,
remembering to do it every day.
Yeah.
So it got me thinking a lot about, these different planner apps and dedicated task managers and, even things like Pomodoro timers and all of that. Versus just, here are my tasks I have to get done, and I do them. So how do you do task management? Do you use any of those specialized apps, or is it just a to-do list? Or since you're within 30 days of retiring, you just have no tasks.
I have lots of tasks, unfortunately. But most of them have to do with retiring, which is a really onerous process, let me tell you. Mm-hmm. The first retirement packet was 29 pages. I have more to do, but anyway. So the answer is two answers. On a personal level, I use Apple Reminders for almost everything. Mm-hmm. It's sort of good enough for me. What do I need to do? When do I need to do it? Where do I need to do it? Since you can do geofencing with it. I drive to a store and I forgot why I drove to the store. Or I forgot the list of things that, I'm supposed to buy there. And it'll say, oh, you're here. You probably want to buy these three things that you said you wanted to buy when you're at this store. And so that. But at work, I have been using Microsoft Planner and also Microsoft, which I think has a new name. I think it's all integrated into To Do now. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But what used to be called Microsoft Planner and Microsoft Lists, which is kind of as I describe it, SharePoint for human beings. Yep. So it's built on the SharePoint list concept, but you don't have to, I don't want to use the programmable. It's configurable.
And it is SharePoint.
It is SharePoint.
I have that same app too.
And so I really like Microsoft Lists. We use it for like change control and all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. Where we need to, share information and easily update. And it's great. But will I use it once I retire? That's a good question. I'm not even sure if I have it available once I retire. Is it available in Personal Office 365? I'll find out. I don't think so.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think, because I'm using it in an education tenant, right, so I don't know if I have it or not. Yeah, the you reminded me of one third-party reminder app I do use, which is an app called AnyList,
Is
an iOS and web app that I use. My wife and I mostly started using it to have a shared shopping list years ago. It also keeps recipes, and you can do recipe planning and meal planning with it. So that's kind of nice. It'll let you immediately add all your recipe contents to your shopping list. If you're saying, oh, I want to make this, what do I need to add in? But otherwise, I try to just use built-in tasks. I used to use a variety of second and third or third-party task managers, and I've kind of gone back on that. But yeah, I'm a big fan of Microsoft lists. And it's funny, I was explaining to someone 2 days ago the evolution of the code bases. I was saying, well, you know, SharePoint is built on the technology Microsoft bought from Vermeer Technologies in the 90s, and that was FrontPage. And then anytime you see a VTI URL, you know that you're looking at some of that older code base, and SharePoint's built on that, and Office or OneDrive for Business is built on SharePoint versus OneDrive, which is built on the old folder share infrastructure that came from a different code base. And so I was kind of saying, this is why these things can talk easier to each other than these other things, because some are built on the same thing and some are not.
On a trivia note, when I was a contractor for the MSN launch team, we met the two guys who created FrontPage, who came, you know, they were Vermeer. And they had just been bought. This was in the like mid to late 90s, I think, probably like 96 or so. And Vermeer had just been purchased by Microsoft, and they came to show it to us at a meeting of the contractors to see, you know, because we were MSN Web, right? And FrontPage was not part of MSN.com, but boy, I sure wish it was, because we were updating web pages using SQL injections. Not a good way to update a web page, in my opinion, but that's the way we did it. I was going to say it was a lot of fun. No, it was not a lot of fun.
That does sound like it.
It was harrowing. Like, did I write the SQL correctly? Yeah, I think so. You know? Microsoft lists. I should check to see if I still have access to it after I retire. I mean, not my work one, of course, but, you know, as part of Office 365. I'm going to look it up now when you start talking. I should note, you know, I logged into iCloud.com, and I noticed that in addition to photos and mail and iCloud Drive being available to you, and notes, which we mentioned earlier, you can also get access to your Apple Work stuff. So numbers, which you talked about earlier, and pages and all that stuff. And reminders, I forgot it's available in that, I should say. So mail, contacts, calendar, photos, Drive, notes, reminders, pages, numbers, Keynote, Find My, are all part of iCloud.com. Mm-hmm. Oh, and did you notice that I think it got turned on? Apple Photos can now synchronize with Microsoft Photos in Windows 11. Not sure about 10.
I did not know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I'm afraid to turn it on, so I have not.
Yeah.
Because I already upload my photos to both Apple Photos as well as OneDrive separately. So I don't see the need to turn that on. But I thought it was interesting.
I agree. Well, my last one is spreadsheets versus dedicated calculation apps. Money management being the one that I think of strongest here. Things like Quicken, and, you know. So I still use a dedicated money manager app like Quicken, but I use spreadsheets for a lot of other things. I use them for a lot of databases that should actually be databases, but they're just spreadsheets. Where do you draw the line between I'll just keep it in a spreadsheet versus I need something more full-featured?
You know, I used to use Microsoft Money, and I also used this is like 20 years ago, because I think Microsoft Money disappeared soon afterwards. And they're both good, and they integrated with some of my financial institutions, so I could, you know, get some automated updates and things for checks. But the synchronization became less and less useful because it just became less and less stable. And I had some questions about security because there was none back then, as far as I can tell. I'm not even sure the data was encrypted to and from financial institutions. 20 years ago, whatever. So I have done everything in spreadsheets, either mostly Microsoft Excel, I have to admit, the lesser level Google Sheets. I really don't use Apple Apple's numbers. I'm not sure I've ever used it, actually. I should probably try it. But I would say Microsoft Excel for almost, for 90% of the stuff I do. At work, it's 100%. And personally, it's a split.
Yeah, I do a lot of the same, what you're talking about, where it's probably 90% Excel. But occasionally, I'll use something else. I do use Google Sheets for one thing that no one else does quite as nicely. And that is directly piping from Sheets into, or a form into Sheets, and then being able to do management in Sheets. And then one of the features that Sheets has that I don't think, and actually I'm probably going to check to see if Office 365 has this, Sheets will let you publish a file as just a CSV. So, and it'll give you a share link for that. And the reason that's useful to me is that I then will use something like R, or another package, to download and open that CSV file directly without having to download it first or something along those lines. So that does make life a little easier. But I don't think I'm opening Excel Online now just to see if Excel Online has a feature like that, but I don't think it does. I think it has to, you always have to download the file. I don't think you can live open it in a format.
Yeah, unless it's published through one of their data sources, supported data sources, you know, via ODBC or something, I think.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, a little, in a workplace, that's not a big deal. But I think, you know, on a personal kind of thing, it's probably a overkill for the vast majority of people. Do you have an ODBC enabled, you know, data secure data source that you use for, you know, how much cat food you buy?
I don't necessarily have that.
I will note that I can't remember if it was when we were MVPs or when I was an MSN contractor, but we had one of the Excel product managers come talk to us about something or other. And this was an in-person meeting, you know, because back then everything was in person in Redmond. And I remember this fella saying, Microsoft Excel is the world's most used database, even when it shouldn't be.
Well, that is definitely true. For better or for worse.
There is something called PowerFX now, by the way, which is, you know, a kind of a Power Automate derived, I shouldn't call it a spreadsheet. I think I was scolded for calling it that once. But basically, you can take a Microsoft Excel model, you know, spreadsheet model, pump it into the web and use FX to program against it. And I have not tried it. And since I'm retiring in like 31 days, I probably won't get to try it. But it was certainly an interesting thing, and I was trying to get people to use it, or trying to get access to it for a while, and then trying to get people to use it. So we will. I just lost a watch face on my Apple Watch. Not sure where it went. Oh, but at any rate, it seemed very interesting, and I would recommend that people take a look at PowerFX if you've got stuff that you want to move out of there. I think I wanted to use it to move people off of Access, since it had Access-like capabilities. Because I know people love Access. In enterprise, I hate Access. Because I lost my database. Did your server go down? No, it was an Access. Oh.
Oh, well, then, yeah, you did. Yeah. Sorry to hear about that, but you're right. You did.
Yeah. How did you lose it? That somebody stole my notebook. Oh.
Well, then, you really did. You've lost a lot.
Yeah,
I'm
and
so
I didn't back up.
That.
And I didn't back up. Why weren't you auto-synchronizing? Oh.
You know, I tell people, my piece of advice is anything that you would cry over losing should be backed up in three places.
Yes.
I mean, if you find yourself thinking, I would just be in tears if I lost that, then there should be at least three places that you have it.
Right. I think photographers have a workflow they call 3-3-2-1 or 1-2-3. Three copies, two different formats, and one on your local device. Although lately the one on the local device is not so much, but definitely. And I think I mentioned an acquaintance of mine who lost had everything on an external drive on a PC, and that drive died. So with no backup, including on the local PC. So that was a little odd, and I have advised this person to look at, who's an Apple person but uses Windows PC, I mean iPhone user. So if you've got iCloud, and take a look at iCloud. And if not, you know, it might be worth spending $100 a year to buy Office 365 for your peace of mind. Mm-hmm. Oh, any rate. So, we have come to the end of Mobilese Podcast 431. Thanks, John. I got to go see if my Evernote account still works. I haven't logged in a while. I hope it still works. I think I exported it once, like you said. And it used to export to something very useful. Was it a CSV? Or an HTML, some kind of HTML file. Yeah. I remember it was just a very sensible way to export things. And I'm now waiting for Twitter to export my Twitter history. I don't know if it's not much of a history. It's mostly, you know, announcing MobileView's podcast. But I used to use it a lot more heavily in the early days. I'd be curious to see what I said, you know, in 2006 or whenever I started using it. All righty. I think we have another podcast or two to go before the holiday season's hit.
Yep.
And so I will see you next week, I think, which is the end of November. We'll see if we can bring one of our friends on board to say a few things, maybe last-minute gift guide or something. I did want to mention that my Charge 5, and I mentioned last week that the Fitbit Charge 5 doesn't have a number of floors climbed or walked anymore, which is annoying as all heck. I have also noticed that its synchronization is really slow now, and I can't figure out why. And it keeps wanting me to add a credit card to it, and I don't want to add a credit card to it. And I can't turn off the notification. Every time I synchronize with the watch, it tells me, do you want to add a credit card? No. It's on the watch, by the way. No.
Not at all. Ever.
No, ever. Yeah. But anyway, I'll have a couple of comments for Fitbit about that. And I can't figure out a way to turn it off. I looked in the app, and annoying. And I looked in the phone. I looked on the Fitbit Charge 5. Alrighty, Mobileview's Podcast 431. Thanks, John.
Mm-hmm.